Welcome to the JPGN Journal Club, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely and Dr. Jake Mann.
SPGN Journal Club of 2026 again with Dr. Jake Mann. It's been a while. Dear listeners, did you miss us? Oh, you missed Jake. Me, not so much. Well, I guess that's Frank. Jake, bless him, has chosen for today's session two studies in metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease. For convenience, henceforward, MASLD, and I've added three. Jake's choices. Well, one addresses the question, can MASLD, I'm not sure what to call it, scoring identify children at high risk of developing type 2 diabetes? And here's a spoiler alert, sort of. The other presents the SPGN consensus on MASLD, what, who, when, where, and why. Full disclosure here, as an authorial alert, Jake's implicated as Lord Preserve Us senior author, although all co-authors are eminently respectable. And my additions, well, the MASLD scoring article depends heavily on a system presented to the world only last year. To understand that system may be important if one is to understand conclusions drawn from its use. I'd like, with listeners, to ask Jake to take apart the article that introduces that system. I'd also like, with listeners, to review an earlier article that reported a correlation between fibrosis in steatohepatitis and susceptibility to development of type 2 diabetes. And I'm going to be interested in what Jake has to say in regard to if the use of MASLD scoring, as set out in Jake's choice, has brought matters beyond where they stood at publication of that earlier article. And then finally, a third scoring system for pediatric MASLD has been developed, and Jake will probably have opinions on which, if any, of these three systems deserves preference. But let's dive in. Jake, your consensus statement doesn't really make much of the scoring systems and of which is better, which is worse. Then again, your choice just pulled into the SPGN station only last autumn. So you may not have had time as you compiled your article to take it fully into account. What do you and SPGN have to share with us on steatohepatitis and MASLD? We'll take on the scoring system later with how to use it and how it's been used if you don't take up all the time. And listeners, this might be a bumpy flight, so fasten your seatbelts. Jake, over to you.
Well, thank you, Alex, for allowing me to slightly entertain myself and the work of our group that we've put together over the last few years in a somewhat self-indulgent podcast for which I will make almost no apologies. I have to make a little bit of an apology, otherwise I wouldn't be appropriately British. But the I think we made, I'd say, three or four main points in the position paper. Firstly, we made clear recommendation on screening, who to screen and what with. Secondly, we made a conclusion on how to diagnose MASLD and using different cutoffs for the cutoffs that were used for screening. We made a recommendation about monitoring, and actually this was a big U-turn from the previous guidance, where we are recommending that blood tests, liver enzyme change is useful. And finally, we made some updates on the guidance on when and when potentially not to use liver biopsy. And I think that at the moment, the evidence quality is good enough for us to produce a position paper. So predominantly grounded in evidence, but with many areas where the evidence was not of randomized high quality and therefore was based on opinion. But we've tried to make clear where and where not the evidence gaps are.
Well, let's cut to the chase then. As a as a one-time histopathologist, why not biopsy? But why not biopsy if the non-invasive studies suggest more than trivial fibrosis? You need to find out how bad the steatohepatitis is, as well as to be quite sure how bad the fibrosis is. Doesn't it seem to you?
And that is one very good argument. The main counter to that is, how is it going to change your management? And currently, there are no drugs in place for pediatric MASLD, and therefore, whether we biopsy in them and show florid hepatitis or and stage 3 fibrosis, or whether we biopsy them and they have moderate steatosis with no fibrosis and minimal inflammation, would not change your management. And that is one argument, and several people in the community, or at least in the pediatric hepatology field, feel very strongly that way. Over time, I have shifted my opinion more towards a pro-biopsy field, particularly in the appropriate clinical context where I'm suspecting advanced disease. I would say my anecdotal experience of where we select the higher risk cases in Birmingham for biopsy, they almost always are severe and potentially more advanced disease than we need, or more advanced disease than we anticipate. And that does give useful prognostic information. The way that it probably is starting to change treatment is that, particularly now, there are drugs licensed for adult MASLD, and those drugs are not licensed in cirrhosis. So if we suspect that a patient is borderline cirrhosis, or we think they may have advanced fibrosis, or they've got progressive splenomegaly, high transient elastography readings, then a biopsy is highly indicated, particularly at the age of 14, 15, 16. So we know where they are at that stage, and therefore we can, as and when those drugs come into pediatric use, we can use those. But even then, when they transition over to adult use, we can get very clear guidance on, yes, this patient's cirrhotic, they need to be managed as a patient with cirrhosis, or no, they need to have targeted therapy for advanced fibrosis with steatohepatitis.
Haven't you just said that there is no targeted therapy for steatohepatitis with fibrosis?
Correct. Currently, for children, there's not, but...
But when they pass the magic age of 18, it's appropriate to give the same drugs?
Apparently, yes. And
I just don't get it.
In Europe, that is the way it currently works. In the US, it is different, and elsewhere in the world, it's different. They have access to GLP-1 analogs that can be prescribed for the indication of obesity rather than for the indication of MASLD, and therefore those children can access those medications. Whereas those medications are currently not prescribable, certainly for indication of MASLD, in clinic for patients with obesity, with comorbidities. So I'm unable to change my treatment at that time. However,
they are not prescribable, you say?
They're not prescribable by a hepatologist. And in general, there is variation, obviously, country to country across Europe. In general, the gastroenterologists, hepatologists find it very difficult to access semaglutide in particular for patients with obesity. They tend to be prescribed by endocrinologists for patients with obesity and established type 2 diabetes rather than those with only, as it were, liver disease.
And not pre-diabetes.
Correct, as it currently stands. But practice is very different to the US.
Jake, to the extent that I know you, I know that you're not above acquiring a pocket pediatric endocrinologist.
I do my best to keep them sweet. However, there is limitations to the degree of manipulation I'm able to facilitate. And has been broadly impossible to access these medications apart from through very stringent complications of excess weight clinics, which are run by the endocrinologists. And even those, they're only able to access a small number. But where we have done biopsies and we've identified children with cirrhosis, then that's been very useful information, because then we would say, well, actually, we may need to exert some caution in, or be at least skeptical about the benefit to the liver of GLP-1 analogs in patients with established cirrhosis, because that's not well characterized yet in adults.
Well, I've thought as I read your state-of-the-art recommendations paper, isn't this being outdated at a galloping pace by the availability of these GLP agonists?
The management part, yes. And that's why we have focused on diagnosis and screening at this stage, and risk and element of risk stratification. I think that it will be valid at least for the next 5 years in terms of the patients who we're diagnosing and screening. But the staging element of it may well change as we get more information on how to use non-invasive markers, transient elastography, and how that plays into treatment algorithms.
It seems unsatisfactory to put a great deal of time and effort into staging with the chance of prognostication, of prediction, when as soon as you have the results in hand, this patient is at substantial risk for diabetes, et cetera. The best you can do is say, well, I moved to Canada.
Yes, it is somewhat unsatisfactory. For a moment, I thought you were about to describe the entire paper as unsatisfactory, but thankfully there was a turnaround there.
I'm only getting started, Jake.
Only getting started. Okay. But I mean, I find it is useful even just sitting in clinic to be able to tell a family, I think your child has mild, moderate, severe. And clearly even the individuals with a so-called mild steatotic liver disease would benefit from comprehensive lifestyle modification to reduce their risk of heart disease and diabetes.
So what you're saying, what I'm taking away from this at the moment is that the grading, the staging, the the prognostication is of value only to the extent of something to brandish at a family.
No, it's also useful for service organization, because not all these patients need to be seen by a specialist gastrohepatologist. Not all these patients need to be even seen by a pediatrician. I think many of these patients who are well and stable, they don't necessarily need medicalizing from a liver perspective, because their risk of liver-related events is, as far as we're aware, relatively low. And therefore, they can still be children and live their lives, even if they're affected by being overweight. Whereas there are a group who absolutely do need monitoring, multiple blood tests, and that is part of the outcome from risk stratifying.
I'm going to challenge your use of the word to see, need seeing by. Can we differentiate that into saying obese children need to be evaluated and stratified at a tertiary center and then can be followed by their pediatrician or their GP?
The experience that we have, at least in our center, and I think it's shared elsewhere, at least in the UK, is that there remains a lot of uncertainty for non-specialists for monitoring or following up children with steatotic liver disease.
They're just going to lift their hands in holy dread and say, I'm not touching that patient.
I think it is somewhere between dread and uncertainty. I think particularly if they have ultrasounds showing or describing hepatomegaly with severe steatosis and splenomegaly. And they get a letter from me saying, no big deal. The liver enzymes aren't that bad. Check them once a year and let me know if they get worse. Then if I say I'm never going to see them again, or I'm not going to see them for 5 years, then that is not necessarily a... many paediatricians or general paediatricians who are not familiar have found that not very helpful guidance. So I do think that oversight from a specialist is needed for some of these children, but not all.
Well, I'm not coming away with a sense of how long that particular piece of string is. Then in terms of which ones need to be, which ones can safely be treated in the community and, as you put it, allowed to live their lives as children, and which ones need to have a dedicated seat in your clinic waiting room.
And you're right, we haven't fully characterized that in this paper because at the moment the data isn't there. A few of us have alluded to that elsewhere in other things we've written, but the evidence is emerging on that. The other challenge for that, particularly in a Europe-wide statement, is those sorts of decisions are very much based around how a healthcare system is set up and whether people have, let's say, a pediatrician that they see regularly in, at the kind of primary care type level, or whether they have a single family doctor and how accessible a gastroenterologist is, hepatologist is. So many of those things will actually also need to come out in country-specific guidance.
Righty-ho. How far are the North Americans, just the North Americans, say, in assessing what these appetite suppressors can do in terms of modifying the course of steatohepatitis in the pediatric age ranges?
So we know from trials done in children and young people with obesity that the liver enzymes go down relative to control, particularly as there is a loss of lower BMI. But what we don't know is actually how people respond in children who have significant and or severe MASLD and steatohepatitis. That there is obviously anecdotal and cohort evidence now showing that if you lose weight, then your liver enzymes get better and some of the liver biopsies get better. But it's not been systematically studied in randomized trials. Those trials are in the process of being planned and will start within the next 1 to 2 years.
What do you hear through the grapevine from Jeff Schwimmer and his group?
That they continue to obviously see MASLD as much of a big problem as it always has been, and that in the children who can tolerate it, then they get improvements with GLP-1 analogs when they lose weight, but there is not uniform response for everybody.
Well, it sounds as if you're starting to call for a repeat stratification as to those that respond and those that don't, and what's the difference between.
Yeah, and that's, I think, going to be one of the key outcomes in the trial. No one would be surprised if we said, if you lose weight, your liver gets better. I think that would be very obvious. The more interesting question will be the nuanced ones of, in the children who don't respond, or perhaps the children who don't lose as much weight, or the children with more advanced disease at the beginning, do they respond to the same degree? And then we're going to be into the really difficult questions about how long you treat people for, when you start, when you should stop. That's going to be the really interesting stuff over the next 5 to 10 years.
You'll note that I invoked Dr. Schwimmer, who's been a lead in this field for as long as I can remember. And, excuse me, I want to adduce his group's work written by Kimberly Newton et al., Incidence of Type 2 Diabetes in Children with Non-Alcoholic Fatty Liver Disease. How did they assess the severity of liver disease in their cohorts?
They were almost all biopsied. I think they were all biopsied.
Aha.
I think you knew the answer to that, Alex.
It's possible. I'm not denying it. So, what does the Belgians' recent work, the second of the articles that you recommended, offer us that takes us beyond Kimberly Newton's work?
What this paper shows to me is it illustrates that this score that has been derived to risk stratify based on risk of liver stiffness, liver fibrosis, the PFIB or PFIB 6 score, that score really is a marker of insulin resistance and long-term risk of type 2 diabetes. And it really helps us understand that score rather than necessarily taking forward our overall understanding of how MASLD behaves in children and young people. The one conceptual advantage that it does have is that almost all the, or usually the data that comes from Jeff Schwimmer's group and most of the children in the NASH CRN, which is the United States cohort, 70% are of Hispanic ancestry, which is not typical of the majority of children seen in Europe. And therefore, there is utility in trying to replicate those studies that have been done by his group in the Europe to understand to what extent it's exactly the same.
Thank you. Jake, I'd love to continue raking you over, but our producer has just given me the high sign to say that we've run out of time. Regrettable, but when are you coming back? And it's going to be another 2 months, is it?
Another 2 months, and I look forward to another defense of a thesis.
Jake, always a pleasure, and I hope that the folks at home have had as good a time observing us chat as I've had chatting with you.
See you soon, Alex.